All right. Thanks for joining me today on the 3-day weekend, May 29th, Memorial Day weekend. Take the time right now to show some love and remember the heroes out there that have fought for us to keep us safe out there. All of the soldiers, and big love to their families. Thank you for what you do. Today is a special day for me. 40 years ago, my mom, shout out, rest in peace, Mom, miss you, borrowed a Toyota Chinook, Google that if you want, from my grandfather, Carl, that was his name. It's a small camper on the back of a Toyota motorhome, but small. I remember my mom said, do you want to go to the prom or do you want to go to the US Festival and see some rock and roll? 40 years ago today, that is exactly what we did. I laughed. She laughed. We knew I wasn't going to the prom. What are you, out of your fucking mind? So she borrowed the Chinook. And me, Eric Wettenkamp, and I believe Tony Halby, guitar player in my band at the time. I think he rode with us, or it was just me and Eric, and Tony went with another guy. I can't remember. And that's how it's supposed to be. Supposed to be a blur. Your mom's cruising you down from the Bay Area all the way down to a place called San Bernardino, just desert, to a concert that Steve Wozniak put on, who was one of the head guys of Apple, called the US Festival. He had done it in 1982. It was a semi-flop. Grateful Dead, a lot of great bands played, but thank God he decided to lose some more money and do it again. He fired it up. It was a 3-day festival. We went all 3 days. No way were we going to drive all the way down to San Bernardino, 7-hour drive. I remember going over the grapevine in that Toyota Chinook, just the 4-cylinder, just screaming, trying to get to the top of the hill. We get to the top of the grapevine. We still got another, 100 miles or so to go. We get there. We bought the campground package. I think it was like $10 a day to camp. And then you just pulled up. And then you walked maybe about 200, 300 feet to some makeshift fence. And you went in and there was this bowl. Kind of they got an amphitheater out there now. It was called Blockbuster for a while, but I don't know what it's called now. But it was just a giant piece of desert with some porta potties, a couple stands to get some corn dogs. You know, I'm talking about prehistoric Coachella. There's no fucking clam chowder bowls or sushi or VIP fucking upgrades. None of that shit. Everybody was out there like a fucking soldier. Not a tree to be found on the hottest weekend of the year. 109, I believe. 106. Some water sometimes would come your way from some gross fire hose the guy was spraying. You didn't give a fuck. You know, you just wanted to be out there amongst people like yourselves. So there we were. Day one. Divinals, In Excess, Wall of Voodoo, Oingo Boingo, Flock of Seagulls, The English Beat, Stray Cats, Men at Work, The Clash. The last show for The Clash with Mick Jones, and really the last show as The Clash in everybody's eyes. Unbelievable. Go to sleep in the Chinook, wake up, fired up, ready for the metal day. Opening band, Quiet Riot. Then Motley Crue wearing their Shout at the Devil gear before Shout at the Devil was even out. Ozzy with Jakey Lee. Ozzy with the shaved head. Judas Priest destroying everyone. in their summer leather. Triumph comes on. Scorpions, Van Halen. Day three, a Monday. Little Steven and the Disciples of Soul. Probably slept through that, fried from the day of metal. Berlin, Quarter Flash, U2, Missing Persons, destroying it. Walking in LA, Pretenders, Chrissy Hynde, showing you how it's fucking done. Look at that. Two women back to back. Missing Persons, Dale Bozzio, and then Chrissy. Joe Walsh, Stevie Nicks, another woman on the festival. David Bowie, Let's Dance era. Absolutely dominating. Us Festival, 1983. I've had the honor to interview a lot of people that have played it, including today. My guest is Mike Levine from Triumph, and it was great to talk to this man. And it's always so cool to hear everybody's perspective, the backstage, how they got there, how they got booked, you know, the gear, the equipment, the sun, the heat, the dust. What was it like? Fucking fascinated with this festival. I cannot believe it does not get more glory. 40-year anniversary of the greatest festival in my eyes, other than Woodstock. There's just no way around it. If you look at this lineup of each day and who these bands became, like U2, way down on the bill, you know, Motley Crue, second on the bill this year, out on a stadium tour. Still going at it. Stray Cats just killing. Van Halen, rest in peace, the great Eddie Van Halen. Scorpions still going at it strong. Judas Priest still doing it. All of these bands still doing it. Rest in peace, David Bowie. Stevie Nicks out on tour right now, killing it. My point is, this thing was special. Not just to me, but I think just in the history of rock festivals, if you look at this, it's just insane. I've got an aerial photo of it. You see aerial photos of Woodstock all the time. You don't see an aerial photo of the US Festival. And when you do, your fucking jaw will drop. There was a zillion people out there. Anyway, it was great to talk to Mike. Triumph has a double vinyl, I think it's double vinyl, set coming out of this concert. Just fantastic human, man. Killer bass player. It was great to talk to him. I was never a big Triumph guy until later on. That sometimes you just find bands later on, you know, you're like, oh yeah, I saw Triumph like 2-3 times, but holy shit, they might have been a little over my head at the time. Just all intricate and badass. Three piece, two singers, Gil killing it back there on the drums. Oh my God. Anyway, what a great guest. I can't even believe the timing of this guest. Just perfect. On the 40-year anniversary of the US Festival. Am I fired up? Fuck yeah, I'm fired up because that festival is drilled into my heart. Great memories with my mom. Great memories of rock and roll. Great memories with my friends that were all out there. There we were together. I remember some girl stole my Y&T shirt. I got a fucking third-degree sunburn. I had those yellow blisters up on my shoulders. I snuck backstage, sat on the grandstand bleachers on the stage watching Judas Priest, scared out of my mind that I was going to get caught, but didn't give a fuck. Watching Rob Halford 2 feet away scream one of the greatest victim of changes ever. Oh my God. I got goosebumps right now. It's just unbelievable how iconic this festival is. And just part of California history. Anyway, thank you so much for tuning in today. I've got something special for you right now. I had a couple weeks ago, I had Ergo on, and we're talking about the hearing aids, and they've decided to offer you guys a special discount right now. Go to ergo.com and get $260 off Ergos. Do it. Use the code BETTER260. That's BETTER260 and get your discount. Okay. I've been using these now for about a month. They work fantastic. You can't even believe. They're microscopic small, man. They're so small. They're not like those old hearing aids hanging outside your ears. I know you guys got hearing damage. If you listen to this podcast, your hearing's fried. So is mine. And who cares what anybody thinks? It's time to, you know, make these things cool. That's what I say. Premium tech without the compromises, all the high tech and support of the traditional hearing aids at a more affordable price, without the tech and support compromises of the new low-end OTC devices. I'm telling you, this thing's real small, goes in your ear. I work it all on my phone with an app. You can get all kinds of different settings. It's great. Perfect, perfect hearing. Unbelievable. Over-the-counter hearing aids, virtually invisible, more affordable, and easily accessible. Eargo.com. Better, BETTER 260 is your code for a discount. And don't be embarrassed, man. That's so weird. People would be like, oh, I don't want people to know I use hearing aids. Who cares? I wear glasses. They're on my face. Nobody says one thing. Hearing aids, you won't even see them. They will be discreetly tucked inside your ear. Eargo.com. All right, I love you guys. And I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I did. And go on YouTube and watch Triumph's set from that day and pick up the vinyl. What a great piece of history that will be. And go watch the other sets. Van Halen, check out The Clash, Joe Strummer. And, you know, everybody up there yelling, you fucking pay The Clash now or we don't go on. There's so many great memories from this fucking thing. David Lee Roth, just terrible. The Clash battling for their money. David Bowie, just smoothly crushing out in the desert. Judas Priest, Motley, oh my God. Joe Walsh, it's all there, man. Here we go. Let's kick ass today. I love you all. Candles lit. Don't forget tour dates coming up. Santa Rosa. What else I got? Alameda, two nights. DeanDelRay.com for your tour dates. A lot of tour dates. Are you hearing me, people? Get some tickets. Santa Rosa is June 8th. June 9th and 10th is Alameda. June 22nd. Giant Center. Where the fuck is that? Hershey Park, Hershey, Pennsylvania. Wow, some big dates. That's with Burr. Arena date here, Bridgeport, Connecticut, June 23rd with Burr. June 24th, Prudential Center, Newark, New Jersey with Burr. Lincoln Valley Casino, two nights with Bill. These are all on the website, DeanDelRay.com. And also, get your merch on the website too. Lots of tour dates. I love you guys all. Have a great day off today. Candles are lit. All right, here we are. Another episode of Let There Be Talk. A fantastic guest today. Introduce yourself, my man.
Hey, Mike Levine from Triumph here. Still alive and well.
Yeah, you look great, man. You always had the best look in the band.
Thanks. No one's ever said that before. That's a compliment.
It's true, man. You just had that incredible kind of 70s Izzy and Marshall Tucker, Skynyrd kind of, you know, that vibe with the jazz bass and, you know, especially that US Festival era with the trucker hat and just killing it, man.
Oh, that's so cool. I miss those days. Those were a lot of fun. Those days were a lot of fun.
You know, when they pitched having you on the show, I immediately said yes, because one of the most epic days of my life, or epic weekends, I would say, was 1983, the US Festival. I was there, and I have talked to numerous people that played the show, Rudy Sarzo with Quiet Riot, Nikki Sixx, Motley Crue, Rob Halford, Judas Priest. So it is an honor to have you on and hear your views and your memories of that incredible weekend.
It was pretty much incredible. I mean, we missed most of the weekend. We were lucky to get there to play because we were in we were playing the day before with ZZ Top at the Tangerine Bowl in Orlando. So we had to fly. We went right from the stage there into a limo, then our stage clothes, right to the airport, changed in the car before we got there, made the flight, and landed in Los Angeles, you know, 5 hours later. Then had a helicopter to the hotel. I call it the motel. That was closest to the venue where everybody was staying. So it was. It started off with that whole the day. So we missed the first day, but so heavy metal Sunday, man. It was the probably it's got to be. It's not the number one career highlight for me. It's the number one and a half career highlight, you know, so it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's interesting because you got to think about Triumph. You know, you guys have your hit in 79 with Lay It on the Line. You played a Canada Jam, which was like 100,000 people or whatever. But this was a whole different thing because you were still kind of culty in America and you were getting some radio play with Fight the Good Fight, you know, and Magic Power. But there was still that thing where Triumph was, you know, it was a kind of a cult following. So it had to be insane for you to play, be part of this.
It was, but, you know, they chose the not only the bands, but the order of billing. Certainly the first four, Van Halen, Scorch, Triumph, Ozzy, Priest. I'd leave it out Crew and Quiet Riot because they were not really, you know, really big yet at that point. But those five bands were the top grossing bands on the tour, on the road. So we were selling out everywhere. And we did on the Allied Forces tour, we sold out everywhere. So, you know, we were hotter than a pistol on the road. You know, Van Halen was number one. On the road, Scorps were two, and we were ahead of Ozzy and Priest, you know, as far as number of people at shows, et cetera, et cetera. So we felt we belonged there. I mean, we turned down. The choice for us was to do three shows at Long Beach Arena or do the S Festival. So we had a decision because the last play in L.A. was at the Rose Bowl where we co-headlined with Journey and did 110,000 people.
Wow.
We were due for an indoor play. You know, with to show the big production, the big Triumph show. And it went right down to the last minute. We were not sure we were going to do it, but they gave us a deadline. And we had Brian Murphy from Avalon Attractions, who was a promoter for the Long Beach shows. He's at the venue because tickets were available only at the venue. His parking lot's full there. We got the team from the S Festival on the other phone going, okay, what's the answer? Deadline's ticking down. And we said, we got to do the S Festival. There's never going to be, this is the ultimate show to, it's going to be historic. So what we opted for.
Now we do know that Van Halen got the crazy money, you know. Was the offer pretty damn big for Triumph?
Yeah. That's like, you know, we got really good dough to play. We didn't get Van Halen money, but you know, we're in the ballpark, so to speak.
Now let's get into that a little bit. So you fly in to the hotel, and was everybody there just getting crazy, or what was happening there?
It was relatively, I'll say, just very low key, you know. My wife met me there, and because that was the last show of a leg we were on, we were going to Palm Springs for a couple of weeks for vacation after the S Fest. So we were, you know, pretty laid back. We were pretty whacked out, tired, but nonetheless, it was still daylight there, and so we're out by the pool, and you know, I was just sitting there holding court with Michael Anthony and. You know, we hit it off, just had a good time, laughed and scratched, and a lot of interviews, a lot of media around and that kind of thing. But it was really kind of very chill and cool.
Now, We know that Joe Walsh was supposed to be on that day, and that's funny because you guys used to cover Joe Walsh, but then he got moved to the third day because he wanted to be with Stevie Nicks, who I guess he was dating at the time, and they put Quiet Riot on. But that would have been an interesting, you know, add into this heavy metal day, right? Because that's kind of a Joe Walsh is incredible, one of my favorites, but he's definitely not. If you looked at that card, you'd be like, what's going on there?
Yeah, that was pretty weird. I thought it was a mistake at first when I first heard that he was going to play on the Sunday. All right, that's impossible. That would be like putting David Bowie on or something, right? Like they just made a mistake. Joel should have been on the Bowie day, kind of, which that's where he ended up, right? But yeah, it would have been great if he was because we would have got him on stage.
Yeah. So you're at the hotel and then it's time to go over to the venue. How many hours ahead before you're on, are you catching Judas Priest? Because at that show, I sat in those bleachers on the stage and watched Judas Priest. Were you guys at the venue while they were on and seeing, I mean, Judas Priest was absolutely destroying it. Were you guys like, oh man, we've got to really go for it? Cause I felt like each band was like going all out.
Yeah, I agree. We were there at the venue when Priest was playing, and I meandered my way up to the side stage for a few minutes just to see if they could survive the heat with the leathers on. But they were fine, you know, they were sweating, but it's like they were killing, and I went, okay, that's great. And I wanted to look because they were on just before we got there. Got settled, and then Priest went on. So I just wanted to go have a look at the setup, right? Because there was no sound checks for anybody, regardless, right? So you're just praying that everything's going to work when you get there. What we had to go through was we have to use rented gear because all our gear was in Florida. So, you know, to have a drums matched up a set of drums like Gil played, had them delivered to the venue, had to hire a drum roadie out there. Rick used Marshall amps, but brought his pedal board, had to run all the amps. I used custom-made stuff I had to use at big SPTs. But it was all okay.
Isn't it wild to think about you're about to play in front of the biggest crowd of your life, zero sound check for any of the bands, even the biggest band, you know, like Nap, you just walk on and hope it works.
It's just you pray, man. You see, if you believe, you pray to whatever God there is, you know? So
now, when you guys finished, did you hang out and watch the rest of the show, the Scorpions and that Van Halen fiasco?
Gil and Rick left as quickly as they could because they were flying back to Toronto. Whereas I was staying because I'm renting a car and driving to Palm Springs with Roses. So we hung out for a while, saw the Scorps a little bit. I thought it was really cool. Like when they got, like David Krebs who managed the band, I should say, who is a smart guy and a good friend over the years. You know, he had the U.S. Air Force do the flyby, if you remember that.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, the Blue Angels.
Yeah, the jets came mad. Zoom. That's very cool. David's a smart guy. So saw a bit of the Scorps and then hung out for Van Halen, who were hotter than a pistol for the first 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And then David started to talk. And David kept talking and kept talking and kept talking and continued to talk. And I, Rosie, let's go to that helicopter. Let's get a helicopter back to the hotel and get out of here.
Yeah, boy, you know, I was there and people hit the gates. They were out of there. It was wild because I had a motorhome. My mom had drove us down in a motorhome and we were staying in the campgrounds. And I think the combination of Dave and it being 1,000 degrees that day, people were just like, I'm out of here, you know?
Yeah, it's tough to play last on a show like that.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is.
It really is. I don't care if you're Van Halen or whoever, right? It's still tough to play last.
Yep. Now, what kind of career change did that happen for you guys after that? Did it give you a big another boost up, like bam, you know? Because after that, or you guys were kind of in between Never Surrender and Fight the Good Fight, Allied Forces era, right, on that?
No, the Never Surrender was out for a while on that.
82, right.
Yeah, because Never Surrender came out late 82 or early 83, I think. So, yeah, we were touring on it, and I can't remember the album. But that's like, so the Us Fest was kind of the culmination of the first leg of the, or second leg of the tour or whatever, because I know we went back out. To answer your question, I guess Thunder 7 was the next record. And we were changing labels at that point. So we had got Thunder 7 was recorded, and we got in a war with the record company and ended up going from RCA, also known as the Record Cemetery of America, to MCA, also known as the Music Cemetery of America. So neither of them knew much about rock bands. I would have given my eye teeth to be on Mercury Records.
It was blazing hot. And maybe the temperature was a little bit dropping by the time you guys were on, but probably not. I just remember it was just a scorcher. How bad was it up there?
It was hot, you know, it's, you know, but you're, you, when you walk up there, you go, it's really hot. And then you got to play and you forget about the heat because you're thinking about other things that you got to worry about. Worse than the heat, I think, because there was really not much direct sun on the stage. They had it covered. Was the dust. The dust was really the tough part to deal with because it was sticking your throat. I don't know how Richard Gill were able to sing, to be honest with you. Like, I had trouble talking, you know, when I had to do any kind of rap stuff. I was like
I feel the Us Festival is very underrated, and you know, because that was basically you know, I'm a junior in high school. And that was my Us Festival. And I will tell you this right now. I went all 3 days. I did not see the country day, but I would say it was probably the greatest festival other than the heat that I've ever witnessed in America. It went pretty damn smooth for how many people were out there. You know, they say there's 670,000. They say there was 1 million. They say there's 300. It's all, you know, whatever.
Nobody knows.
Nobody knows. It's true. I've got an aerial photo of the venue why Judas Priest is on. Somebody shot from a helicopter, and it looks insane. You know, I mean, the amount of people.
Yeah, it's like when we were flying in for the site, we're looking down out of the chopper and going, oh, man, there's the size of a small city going on down there. You know, it's like just tons of people, like no empty space, just people, people, people.
I do often say that that was the day that I think that record companies and the industry were like, oh, wow, we need to go out and sign us some rock and metal bands. Anything with leather, grab it, right?
Probably, yeah. I would think so. Although I don't think any of the record companies were there. You know, there's just...
Oh, they're not there, but they're seeing the numbers and they're seeing the footage and you know, on the news and everything. They got to be going like, what's going on out there?
Yeah, although, you know, record companies were never noted for their smarts, you know. So it's like, who knows? They always thought, you know, heavy rock, heavy metal, whatever, was like, you start off saying, oh, somebody says, oh, it's just a cult thing. Right. Meanwhile, it was selling billions of records, billions of concert tickets. It was the biggest thing going. But it's like, it's a cult thing.
Now, also an interesting thing with Triumph and a lot of bands back then was, you know, you have Lay It on the Line, but that's in 79. These days, if you didn't have a song hit on the first record, you're gone.
Yeah, that's for sure, man. There was a used to be a thing called artist development back then. And it was like, okay, you didn't have to have a massive hit on your first record. Now, if you don't have a hit in the first 20 minutes, you're gone. History. It's like scary.
Isn't that crazy to think about? Because
it is and it isn't. Because, you know, for my 10 cents worth, the quality of music has gone from being really, really good to being really, really average in general. Like I used to say 5-10 years ago, I go, could someone please play a guitar solo for me on a record? You know, it was just guys hacking around playing power chords, and but nobody with any chops. Like, you know, if you went to the local music store, you could play it a bit because the guitar players were nowhere, you know. But when bands did have guitar players, they did really well, you know. AKA, you know, if you take a band like Nickelback, right? But was really kind of a throwback to that late 70s, mid 80s era. Everybody hated the band. It's the best, still hates the band. But they're a great band. The fans love them. They sell millions of records still, and sell concert tickets, you know.
Yeah, that was an interesting thing. I met the Nickelback guys last year, and super cool guys. And then you sit back and you think about, like, hey, why are these guys the whipping boys? There's so many bad bands out there without songs. I mean, they got songs, you know, that are being their hit songs. Maybe you're not into that style or something, but it's, you know, there's some songwriting there, 100%.
Yeah. So it's like, yeah, there are some good bands that are around. I'm not saying everything's bad.
Yeah.
But, you know, it used to be like baseball. You know, you'd always have every week or two, there'd be a really good band in town. You know, Triumph would be there. 2 weeks later, Journey would be there. 3 weeks later, AC/DC would be there. A month later, The Scorps. So 2 weeks, The Priest. Blah, 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 right? It was like going to a baseball game all the time, right? It's like, okay, here's all the teams that are coming to town. I want to go see them.
Yeah. What was it like at the early days of Triumph, because you've been there since the beginning. And so were you guys start out as a cover band, or were you just kind of doing that three sets a night in bars? What was happening there?
Well, we didn't have a lot of original material when we started, because we didn't have a lot of original material yet. But we decided that we were going to do, who's the best of the best that we could play, pull off, and make sound good, that we could compartmentalize into one 30-minute set that we could do in clubs, that would start and it would finish. There'd be no breaks in between. You know, you start at second one and you end at minute 30. That, for two reasons. One is, if you really sucked, nobody would be throwing apples at you or tomatoes. They'd have to wait till the end to throw shit at you. So we did Led Zeppelin, which Rick could cut vocally, and we could play, you know, so we do a medley of Led Zeppelin stuff. Deep Purple, one of our favorite bands, do a medley of Purple. And Hendrix, do a medley of Hendrix. Then we do a fourth set that would be whatever original material we had, and maybe one or two other covers, Snoopy Brown Ears or something. I think we played Wasn't It Confused, like the China Crowd, one of those. But by then, the audience loves us. We played some of their favorite music. We blew off pyro. We had more lights than any other band on the road, the Flint Flyers. And it was an exciting show. The fans went crazy. So they accepted our original music, right? And encouraged us and that kind of thing. So slowly we eliminated the cover stuff, and as we got more material. So that's what we did in bars, and it worked. You know, there's one bar was our hometown in Toronto on Yonge Street, which is a main drag. It was called the Piccadilly Tube. It was kind of downstairs. It had a low ceiling. It was a rough overhead for the crew. But we used to, you know, we got to the point where we'd only play there on weekends. We wouldn't play weekdays because we wanted to have the place jam. So at one point, we said, okay, we did do weekdays. Then we said, we can't do that anymore. So we're just going to do weekends, but we're going to do turn the crowd over. So, you know, there's a cover charge. You know, you got to see the show once, and then we it went for a whole new crowd. And we, at that point, we had bought a trailer. We owned our own trailer, semi-trailer, 40-foot trailer, but we didn't own the cab yet. But we'd park it out on the street in front of the club. The people walk by and go, what's going on down there? There's a semi parked in front. It must be something special. So we attracted people with that. Got a lot of parking tickets, but it was worth it. So that's kind of how we developed. And when we played high schools, which was really the the lifeblood, kept us alive. It all was sense. But we really stopped playing clubs altogether. The high schools were really our bread and butter until they fired us because we went to five roller. We wanted beer and the dresser, so we couldn't play high schools anymore. you know, we put on a big show and did the best of the best, did our own tunes, did some Zep, did some Hendrix, you know, and mixed them in with our own stuff. And we developed a following doing that. So then we got a record deal, or we had a record deal already, but we didn't make a record for a while, but we had a deal.
You had a deal before you had a band? How'd that happen?
A friend of mine, I used to have a record label before Triumph. I did a lot of things before Triumph, but as a partner in a record label, you know, we weren't a big record label, a small record label, didn't have a ton of dough, but we, you know, we had a couple of it. And a good friend of mine, I made friends with a guy who was the head of promotion for Warner Brothers Records in Canada. And we had been at industry functions and stuff, and hit it off, really nice guy. So whenever he was going to do a cross Canada tour, he'd invite me to tag along. So when he did a big show and tell for all the radio people in town, yeah, I'd be attended there. He introduced me to all the radio people all across the country, which was cool. Then he left Warner's and started the label beside us, Attic Records, along with a guy named Al Baer, who managed Brent Lightfoot. Ford passed away recently, just like last week, and his Al Baer, who was Tom's partner, passed away like a month ago. So it's kind of weird. There's deaths everywhere now. But anyway, so Tom, I went to Tom. I said, I got a proposition for you. I said, I could start this band. It's going to be heavy metal. It's going to be three piece. And we're going to just change the world. He goes, really? And I go, yep. He says, how much do you need in advance? I said, yep. And Gil and I, we didn't have any guitar players, Gil and I. So he said, so when will there be a band? I said, as soon as we get the right guitar player. And we went through a bunch of guys, and then we found Rick and convinced him it would be a smart move for him to come in the band. And here's a record label, and here's a deal, and we're going to make records and all that. And he went, I'm in. So that's how really we started.
I tell you, man, those vocals between Gil and Rick are unbelievable. And I really feel that Gil and, you know, Gil is drumming and is singing are very underrated. You just don't really hear much people talk about what he was doing, you know?
I agree with you 100%. You know, he's a very, very player and a very good singer, you know? And it's like, but, you know, drummers and singers, you know, you think about it, there's not many of them. The guy in Rare Earth, I think, was the singer.
Yeah, the Eagles, Phil Collins, Gil, you know, it's rare.
It's rare. There's not a lot. Just like there's not a lot of three-piece bands either, right? So but it was good because, thank God, because it gave us that opportunity to break, you know, because there's no way one guy could carry a whole show mixing it up in that high register all the time. So it was, it worked out great. You know, having two singers was the best thing. But, so you're right about that, sure.
Was the high register influenced by Robert Plant era and Rush and that? Because there was that era where guy, you know, Boston, where they're just singing high, man.
Dirty, you know, dirty. You know, it's like, that's Rick's voice. That's a singing voice, right? Sometimes he went beyond a singing voice, way beyond. Like sometimes he did, you know, a high E over C and stuff. It was like massively strong. I could bring tears to your eyes.
Yeah, it's interesting. When you hear the Lay It on the Line Us Festival version, man, first of all, that version has really got some muscle. And then he just goes up higher, you know, and you're like, whoa.
Yeah, take me to another level, folks. Take me to another level, you know. I used to be fun in the studio with him. I go, Rick, you're being lazy. You could kick it up a notch here, you know. And he goes, okay, get me a beer. No, he didn't drink beer. One day, I got a glass of wine or something. He said, put up some penthouse pictures or something, you know, give me some inspiration and turn the lights down low and let me try. And sure enough, he did it. You know, it's amazing.
Yeah. I was reading something where Steve Perry was like, you know, I just kept trying to go higher and higher and higher. And there's just no way now. Now, some people could do it all the way to the end, say like a Dio, Rob Halford still gets up there pretty high. Cornell was up in there, Chris Cornell. But yeah, you're not thinking back in 1979 when you're laying down the track that you're going to possibly be singing this 20 years later, you know?
That's for sure. So just anecdotally on that level, there's a Triumph tribute record being done in Los Angeles that Mike Clank, producer of, you know, Guns N' Roses, Appetite for Destruction, White Snake, Crew, Mike's worked with everybody. So his job was to find artists that would, you know, cover Triumph songs. And they do their own arrangements, whatever. Great bands, you know, Kenny Aronoff and Phil X playing guitar. And just, you know, incredible stuff. But a lot of guys passed because they couldn't do the Rick songs, right? It's just probably because we're looking for classic rock guys. And talk to Paul Rodgers. Paul Rodgers says, I can't do that. I don't want to embarrass myself. It's like kind of, there's a lot of guys that just pass because, no, I can't touch that and do it justice.
Once Rick B, you guys do one more record and then you kind of call it quits. And then you did some gigs over the years sporadically, but there's no way you guys are ever going to get back together, right?
You mean to tour, to do a tour?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think we're physically able to do that. I mean, we did three songs for the documentary, and it was like rough A tooling up, just, you know, because Gil and I hadn't played it a while. And Rick was always playing. He was out on the road a lot. So he had good patience while we were hacking around trying to figure out, you know, I was trying to figure out, where is my head going here? And Gil's going, what's a drum? But Rick had good patience. And after three or four rehearsals, we started to find the groove. And then when we actually did the gig for the fans for the documentary, three songs, we were dead to the earth. Honestly, I was like, just give me 14 vodkas, and I just want to pass out. You know? So the idea of a whole show, don't think so. I just like to say, Rick can't really hit those notes anymore. Even when you drop the key a bit, still not easy. Well, yeah, we all got it for Gil's have really hard of hearing now from having water so loud all those years. You know, so it's really tough and you're getting older.
What have you been doing since you don't do music? Once that train stops and it's most of your life, was it tough to figure out what you wanted to do in life? Were you missing the adrenaline? What's going on there?
So, you know, it was tough when the band just kind of stopped. And, you know, it's like without any, there was no kind of, okay, let's take the train down the track slowly, but keep it moving. It just went from, okay, we just played for 18,000 people in Toronto, and the headline in the paper the next day is Rick leaves the band. And it's kind of like we went, that's not the way it's supposed to work. But shit happened, so that's the way it was. So yeah, every time I went past the airport on the highway, it's a steering wheel was going to the right, because I never went past the airport. I always turned into the airport from the highway. It was like just a reflex action, right? I've done it so many hundreds of times. And so I missed it. But, you know, Gil and I started, I guess in 1990, we started jamming with some people and using the studio and doing some recording. Then we finished a record with Phil X on guitar, the Edge of Excess record. So that was kind of, that kept things kind of in a groove. Went out and played some dates with Phil. Well, got him the gig at Bon Jovi, so he's really happy for that.
Yeah.
Very happy for that. He's all over this record, the tribute record. Phil was always available to play for Clay. So anyway, so that kept us kind of busy. You know, we played a few dates. And in the meantime, I was trying to clean up business because it was a mess. Just everything happened so suddenly. So I was there. I went, became kind of a legal beagle a bit and an accounting a bit, and went, okay, let's figure out who owes us money. Went after the record companies, found a whole bunch of dough that they owed us, like a whole bunch. And, got out of some bad arrangements, made some new friends, made no enemies at all, just friends. And so we, periphery-wise, you know, I was around the business. Then because our agent, our lawyer was smart back when we signed with MCA, he put in a clause that we get all the rights back to the material, all the records we owe it again after a certain period of time.
Wow.
1993 comes along and it's time to send letters to MCA saying, please return all master tapes, all artwork, all materials, all blah, 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 blah. And all of a sudden, you know, the phone lights up. What do you think you guys are doing? They're checking contract calls. And they went, yeah, you're right. They went about it. They returned everything, which was great. So then, like my job, I became like the Triumph label manager and retooled everything, you know, redid all the artwork because they got such a cheap note on the CDs when they first came out. Started our own label and did very well. They're repackaging stuff. And so that was kind of my hobby. It was a hobby, but it was something to do every single day. That kept going for a long, long time until we sold the catalog recently, a few years ago, to Roundhill
Music. Oh, you guys sold the catalog? Excellent. That seems to be the way to go these days, right? Sell the catalog, because we really don't know what music's going to be worth down the road because the streaming, the money has dwindled. And especially now in this AI world where people can just go, you know what, I'm just going to have this AI machine do a Triumph style song and I'll play it at the NFL commercials and I don't have to pay anybody.
Yeah, well, that's going to be interesting, Leo. The lawyers are going to make a lot of money parsing that, you know, somewhere, somehow. But yeah, it's kind of, you know, we looked at it too, like estate planning, you know, you're getting older. And, you know, Gil and I go out for dinner one night, we get hit by a bus, you know, and our wives now own the catalog, they're going to get screwed, right? So, but, you know, who's going to be kind to them about getting the right price for anything? So we figured the smart thing to do was to, let's find a buyer. And, you know, our lawyer in New York found a buyer. That's like I went to visit him. I hadn't been to New York in years. I went to visit him. I said, Paul, you know, it's like the catalog's for sale. And like, you know, that was 4 years later, we made a deal because we had offers, but they weren't good. And I just said, no, you know, I'm not interested. And then the right offer came along. I'm like, yes, let's go for it.
That's amazing, man. That's amazing to be able to sell that catalog and that you owned it. You know, a lot of people don't understand. Most people get the rights to their material back after 30 years. But, you know, by then it's so gnarly. A lot of people aren't even around anymore and people are just battling. So it's great that you got that back. You're able to sell it and be able to live without freaking out, you know?
Well, yeah. And plus it was, it made us a lot of money, you know, while we owned it. You know, we owned it for how long? You know, 20 odd years, right? And it was made, you know, so we sold a lot of records, like a lot of records, you know. So instead of, you know, getting your little puny royalty, you know, we're getting the whole, and we had great suppliers, great manufacturers, great people that worked, you know, where we needed new artwork or whatever. We had the studio and a mastering facility so we could pick stuff up. We could, you know, remaster it and all that. Expenses were low, and I worked for free. So it was okay. You know, it was a good deal. But now, like, we're able to do this US Festival thing that's coming out, right? The vinyl. And, you know, limited edition. Nobody could afford to do that. You know, it makes no sense to make 750, you know, vinyl tape full of rent. But we owned all the art. The artwork was ours. We had the photos to be able to, you know, take a nice staple set and put it together. Gil owns the studio, so the mastering room to remaster it, you know, took a long time to get that done properly. And, you know, and our merch company is putting it out. So you can buy it from the Triumph merch store, but you can't go to Amazon and get it.
That's amazing, man. It's such a piece of history. Those US Festival sets, I mean, they are fantastic. Each band was firing with all cylinders. Everybody was hungry and everybody wanted to kill. And, you know, it's just a day in history that will never be duplicated ever.
Well, I don't think you'll ever get that many headliners in the same room again, so to speak, right? I mean, that's why it's like you want to be there with your peers. And that's, for us, that was like, that was the deciding factor. It wasn't about the money. It was about you're there with your peers. These are the top bands of the day, and you're part of it.
It's a lot like, you know, Bill Graham, what he did with those Dan and the Greens. You know, you'll never get any of those lineups again, you know.
Right. We played, I don't know, probably five or six Dan and the Greens with Bill. But Bill was actually the original promoter of the US Festival. Right. He was the buyer. He worked for Woz. And then for some reason, they had a falling out. And then Barry Fay from Fayline Productions in Denver, you know, kind of took over. And that's who we ended up dealing with, right, mainly. But we did deal with Bill a little bit in advance of that.
How great was Dan the Greens? I mean, I saw you with, I think it was Sammy Hagar one I believe it was the maybe Danger Zone tour for him. But those were just unbelievable, right? Like, if you look at those bills, some of them I saw would be like Ted Nugent, Aerosmith, AC/DC, Journey, Cheap Trick. You're just like, what? You know?
Yeah, Bill had a knack. He was a very, very good promoter. He wasn't well liked by a lot of agents, but he was a very, very good promoter. We got a lot of great with him. So, but our agent wouldn't deal with him at all. He'd say, you go make the deal with Bill. I don't talk to him. It was amazing. And Bill would go, okay. He'd come in the dressing room after the show, and we sold out the Cow Palace, and he came in, and there was a war in advance about how to advertise the show. We said, Bill, you have to use TV. You know, so you can't just put an ad in the newspaper and expect to sell out this band. So we found, I said, you know, I think you'll need to deal with it. Just take our guarantee and just buy TV with it. Okay? That's it. You won't have to pay us a nickel unless we get the first money's out. And sold out the Cow Palace. Bill comes in the dressing room and said, so who's going to do the settlement? Because we got no agent, right? To do it. It went back to Bill. We just said, write us a check for what you think's fair. But Bill was notoriously a crook, you know, when it came to settlements. I saw both promoters were. But he wrote us a bigger check. We told Troy, rest his soul, our agent, what the check was. He went, I can't believe that. Like, you know what? If I would have been involved, you would have got half that.
Wow.
So that's why we like Bill a lot. You know? So that's for the Triumph World. There's the vinyl coming out. And there is we're doing the US Festival concert. The Triumph US Festival concert has been never on the Triumph official channel, which is like for some stupid reason it never was. So it's moving there. It's moved there, and will be there on the night of the 25th of this month of May. They're airing it for the first time on the Triumph channel on YouTube. And Rick, Mike, and Gil will be on the keyboard answering, you know, having chats with the fans during the airing. So that'll be cool. So that's kind of our festival celebration stuff.
That's amazing, man. Congrats on everything. Glad you're still alive and all these years of just fantastic music and the US Festival. I'll never forget it, and I'm sure you never will forget it. Get this record on vinyl, everybody. The US Festival, the entire Triumph set, and check them out on their YouTube and all of that. Thank you so much for doing the show, my man.
All right. My pleasure. It's been fun. You take good care. Look forward to next time.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Peace out.
See ya.